Hello and welcome to The Bagel Bite, the part of The Bagel podcast where I've tried and failed to circumcise enough to go into a main episode. And with Clive Lawton, it was always doomed to failure, as he's just too interesting. If you don't know who he is at the moment, carry on listening and you'll find out. We cover how he formed Holocaust Education in the UK, his work with Jewish youth movements, and education as a whole. He shares general leadership tips, and of course, we discussed his background with Limud. It was a bit of a surreal experience to have Clive in my flat. I'll paint the picture. He knocks on my door with turquoise jeans and a turquoise long-sleeve t-shirt, his trademark ponytail and beard, and wearing sandals. No socks, no coat, in December. As I'm a fantastic host, if I do say so myself, I offer Clive a cup of tea, making care to tell him that my milk is not kosher supervised. Before I hit record on our interview, what then followed was, well, I don't know what it was, a talk, a lecture, a something, about how he would have been more offended if I had kosher milk. He touched on Midrash, the role of the Sanhedrin, and the commercialisation of kashrut, and this was before the interview had even started. Before I hit play on our interview, please could I ask that you share The Bagel with at least one friend, or even better, be like Noah and get two on board. It really does help us out considerably. Anyway, enjoy. So it's my pleasure to be joined by Clive Lawton, OBE, who's here in my flat. Surreal experience for me. Welcome. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm fine. It's quite a surreal experience for me as well. All's well.
Right. It's just because we're so used to seeing each other either at Warwick University or at a hotel in Birmingham for Limud that this is just out of our comfort zones, right?
Yes, it's a bit like little children at primary school when they see their teacher in the shop, but they just can't believe that the individual exists out of context.
Right.
But it's nice to know that we both really do exist.
I know it is. It is good, yeah. But I'd say that just for the majority of listeners, especially at the moment, because this is going to go out on the first episode, will probably know you, or at the very least know somebody who knows you. But for those who don't, I mean, I've previously described you as Mr. Limud, but then that also presupposes that people know what Limud is, right?
Yeah, absolutely. To assume that most people know me is really highly unlikely. It becomes very, very easy to be a big fish in a small pool and think that everybody knows who you are. But the fact of the matter is that out there, the vast majority of people don't. It's perfectly possible for me to go to a Jewish food shop and not greet anybody I know. And I think that, in fact, I had this brought home to me very forcefully many, many years ago. It must have been in the 1980s or so. I'd already made a bit of a name for myself. I was working at the Board of Deputies and so on. And I was approached by a publisher to produce a series of primary school books for children about religions. And it was my job to kind of design the books, suggest what they should look like and how they should work. And I suggested that these books should be called I Am A, whatever it was, Christian, Rastafarian, whatever it might be. And the design would be a child talking about their lives in this religion. There would be a picture per page. There'd be a little sentence from them. This is me lighting the Chanukiah or whatever it might be. And then a little paragraph from me, as it were, saying Chanukah is the festival of. That was the idea. So the editor that I was talking to was very pleased with this and went off to the publishers and said, this is what we're planning to do. And they came back and said, we're going to do the first six books, and what we thought we'd do is I am a Rastafarian, I'm a Catholic, I am a Buddhist, I am a Muslim, I am Jewish, I am... And I said, why I am Jewish? Why not I am a Jew? And they said, are you sure that's not offensive? Is that all right? And I said, no, that's fine, I am a Jew. It's okay. Oh, all right. Well, no, fine. If you think that's all right, fine. So the book came out, very well received, sold into all kinds of libraries and schools and whatnot around the country. And they got a letter from Mrs. Goldblum or Goldberg or Rosenberg or something or other from Stamford Hill. She'd found the book in Hackney Library and wrote to say that she had no idea who this Clive Lawton was, but if only he'd consulted a Jew, he would have known how offensive this title is.
I think before all the... all the dodginess happened. Louis C.K. did a routine about it where he said that Jew is the only word that he could think of that's both a, you know, ordinary descriptor and an insult.
Well, I mean, there are probably others. I mean, black, I think, probably has that same effect. And maybe even, I don't know, Welsh or French. I mean, it all depends what side of whichever line you're on. Irish, maybe, right. I don't know. Groups of people like to be contemptuous of. But also, it is interesting. I mean, Jew does do something to your face when you say it. It just kind of scrunch it up a bit, Jew. It kind of scrunches your mouth and your right. nose in together. It's not an expansive word. It doesn't make you smile. Jew is not easy to say with a smile. So I think it does have some of that... aggression to it, but my goodness, we've got to reclaim it, haven't we? You know, Jew is beautiful.
Yes, it is. And we're two beautiful Jews.
Yeah, speak for yourself. Lucky this is radio.
So, yeah, I just wanted to kind of go back then, right? Because you seem to have... Every time I have a conversation with you, I learn that you've had a different role somewhere else.
Yeah, well, if you keep moving, they can't get you. That's the basic principle. I started out as a teacher, English and drama, and fairly quickly found myself at JFS, the school. A bit of a surprise to me. I grew up in West Ealing, right out on the west of London. I went to the small Ealing United Synagogue School, and that's where I grew up. A very enthusiastically Jewish family, quite uncommon as a Jewish family in the sense that my mother was Sephardi from Gibraltar, and my father was from... deep, long English Jewish stock, highly assimilated family, actually. And he, therefore, learnt most of his Judaism from my mother. So our domestic practices were all Sephardi, and our synagogue practices were all Ashkenazi. But we were Shomer Shabbat, we kept the rules of Shabbat, and I always said that we were the only amateur Shomer Shabbat family in Ealing, because you had the rabbi and the kosher butcher and the chazan. But I think we were the only people losing money out of keeping Shabbat. You know, everybody else was making a living. And so I grew up in this family. It was tremendously positive and enthusiastic Judaism. I didn't have a lot of that oy vey, lacrimose Jewish. Isn't it tough being Jewish thing? Mm. I didn't have the Yiddish tradition, didn't have any real access to the Holocaust story. My parents were from long-standing, proud and out, aren't we lucky to be Jews kind of thing. Anyway, so that's what I grew up in. I became a teacher, and as I say, went to JFS. I don't think I'd seen so many Jews all in one place. I had, as a youth, I'd got very involved in a youth movement, which no longer exists, called Jewish Youth Study Groups. And that was a fabulous movement. It did what it says on the tin. It's Jewish, it's youth that had studied it.
I really wanted to go. It never got to Leeds.
No, we never had a group in Leeds. But I became national chairman, and that resulted in me swanning around the country and going to Newcastle and Glasgow and Cardiff and wherever, Brighton and so forth, and meeting Jews from all around. And these summer and winter camps were tremendously enthusiastic places. And that enriched my enthusiastic Jewishness still more. Anyway, I became a teacher. I turned up at JFS, which gave me a different insight, I guess, into the way that the Jewish community is and behaved and felt. And then I went from there to the Board of Deputies, where I became Director of Education and Community Relations. Got very involved in sort of interfaith stuff, interreligious stuff, and religious education, and became something of a maven on RE and religious studies. Subsequently doing a master's degree in Hinduism and Islam as a result of that. Became Chief Examiner for A-level and so forth. While at the Board of Deputies, got very involved in Holocaust education. Perhaps it should be said that there was no Holocaust education when I arrived at the Board of Deputies. It simply did not exist. I know this is really difficult for people to believe, but in 1979, when I got to the Board of Deputies, nobody knew what Holocaust education was, let alone what it could look like. It simply didn't exist.
What, did you mean full stop?
Full stop. There were a few youth movements that were occasionally on Tisha B'Av or some other miserable day doing some program designed to upset their children and, you know, make them cry, whatever. They would use the Holocaust in that context. There were, of course, schools doing the Diary of Anne Frank, which, of course, was terribly upsetting as a book. But when you think about it, of course, it finishes just as the Holocaust element starts. So you don't really get into that. Except for the sort of dot, dot, dot at the end of it. The World at War, which had been a big sort of landmark BBC programme had an episode narrated by Laurence Olivier called Genocide. But I mean, that was a TV program, wasn't a school thing. There simply nobody talked about it. Simply nobody talked about it. When I was at the Board of Deputies, I became responsible for organising the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising Memorial Meeting, where a lot of elderly people with Central European accents came and made sad statements, and a few children lit candles and whatever. But nobody knew anything. And of course, remember that the vast majority of the lands where the Holocaust happened, specifically the Nazis used Poland for that, didn't they? That was more or less cut off from us. We couldn't get there because of the Iron Curtain. So nobody could visit or see any of it. So three things happened soon after I arrived at the Board of Deputies. One of the American networks, CBS, whatever, something like that, produced a mini-series called Holocaust, which was a sort of 2-3-night glossy Hollywood show. Lots of Jewish people were tremendously purist about it and thought it was disgraceful and, you know, not enough people died, it wasn't honest enough and all the rest of it. But the fact that it was kind of quite a romantic-y sort of story and quite glossy meant to say that lots of people watched it. The result of that was that lots of people started asking questions. How come I didn't know about this before? The second thing that happened was that the Bishop of Stepney, the then Bishop of Stepney, had visited Auschwitz and had negotiated, so this is the communists still, had negotiated that he could bring to the crypt of, is the Stepney Cathedral, or whatever it is, his place. He could bring to the crypt elements from the Auschwitz exhibition, and he could set up the Auschwitz exhibition. And this was tremendously warmly supported by the then mayor of London, who was a furious anti-fascist, of course, because he was a hard left man called Ken Livingstone. And Ken Livingstone and the then Inner London Educational Authority, ILEA, decided that they wanted educational materials to go with this so that all schools in ILEA should go and see this Auschwitz exhibition. And nobody knew what sort of material to produce. And they came to the Board of Deputies, and there I was, education director. And I was given the task of producing this pack, and I drew together a bunch of teachers. None of us had a clue how to start. Let's just remember that when I was at school, 20 years earlier than that, in the 1960s, I did an O-level history, modern European and British history, 1914 to 1951. Anybody whose history is not strong and needs to be reminded that that spans the years of the Second World War and the Nazi period. I did that course. Like I said, I was a proud, out, happy, confident, educated Jew. At no point in that course was the Holocaust mentioned, and at no point did I think it was odd.
Wow.
It just wasn't on the agenda. And one of the reasons why was because everybody said, well, this is just too upsetting. You can't do this with small children. And I discovered that, in fact, it wasn't even on the curricula of modern history programs for undergraduates, because generally historians at universities felt it was too upsetting for people so young. Indeed, one of the loud voices resisting putting it into such programs was a well-known Jewish historian of the time.
Was that because they felt that it was too soon?
Well, I don't know about too soon. We're now talking about the 1980s. I think that they felt it was too upsetting. You see, when you haven't processed something yourself, you don't know how you want to talk about something, then you don't want to teach children about it. Let's face it, we've had the same thing with drugs education or sex education or anything else. This is all to do with the fact that teachers are worried about getting upset when they talk about it, because kids aren't. They couldn't care less. They don't talk about anything. It's teachers who are scared, and therefore they just don't want to talk about anything which might upset them. And the Holocaust is a good example. So when I approached the A-level boards from the Board of Deputies to ask why this wasn't on the syllabuses, they said, well, it's just too upsetting. And I said, if I can devise a pedagogy and a syllabus and a curriculum that can be taught to this age group, that fits this age group, will you put it on the syllabus? They go, well, of course, it's missing. It should be there. So I did, and they did.
It seems like a ridiculous excuse that it's too upsetting. You know,
well, it was real. It was real. I mean, after all, why don't we do perfectly straightforward things? Like, for example, like sex education in a series. Why didn't we do that for ages? Well, because it was just kind of, oh, I don't know, you know, you don't want to.
I was expecting it from the other way, that it would be that it was difficult to find enough survivors to speak because it was too recent for them to talk about.
Yes, in those days, nobody was talking about survivors. Right. No, that wasn't on the agenda at all, as far as I recall. I then went to the O-level boards, as they were then, the GCSE things, and said, why isn't this on the curriculum? And they go, well, it's too upsetting for children of this age. And I said again, you know, if I, and they said yes, and it went on to the GCSE syllabuses. And then the national curriculum was established in 1988. And I felt that if you could get this into key stage three, because that's the time before people give up history, then everybody would do something about the Holocaust. So again, I went to the National Curriculum Council. I was on the National Curriculum Council for English and RE.
Of course you were.
Right, well, there you are. So I went and said, why is this not on the history curriculum? They go, well, the kids are too young. They're only 14. And I said, if you can teach it. And they said, yes, well, you can. And so it is now in key stage three. And then subsequently, I produced the first book. And to this day, so far as I know, the only book, history book on the Holocaust designed for middle school children. Children age nine.
Well, that's a bit, middle schools don't exist anymore. So that's,
well, but that age group, the top juniors into lower.
No other books exist.
Not history books. Not history books. There are sometimes slightly disgraceful books, you know, like The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas, which leads people to think that they've dealt with the Holocaust, even though it's a fiction and not very accurate one.
Right, for example, A Detail of History. I don't know if you know Arik Hirsch, who's a survivor up north.
You wouldn't give that to 10-year-olds.
No, I think it's designed for... No, you probably won't
give it to...
Yeah, it is older.
It's key stage three.
Yeah.
It's 11 to 14, and that's fine. I mean, I'm not saying everybody's got to study it at age five, but of course it's just true to my own convictions that there is no subject you can't teach any child at any age. The key is in determining the best way to deliver it. You know, all this nonsense about whether you can do drugs education with preschoolers. Of course you can. It's just find the right things to say and the pertinent issues. Kids ask questions. Kids are interested. They don't carry all the guff that adults carry.
And that probably makes it better, right? So it means
So that was one of the things I did at the board, was getting involved in this Holocaust education field. And I would say probably inventing it for school age back then.
But how did you, what inspired you to do that?
Well, it was just obvious. Education is necessary, isn't it? I mean, if there's a field that ought to be known, then it ought to be known. I was certainly prompted, not least by the Inner London Education Authority and the Auschwitz exhibition at Stepney. So it was a Christian and an anti-Semite who made me do this. I think, you know, there's a field of knowledge and nobody knows how to teach it. Well, I mean, that's just a gift, isn't it? You've got to explore that. You've got to know how to do it. But that, of course, was not the only thing I was involved in there. And while I was there, three friends and I got together and invented Limud. And I was very happy to be able to use the kind of air cover, I suppose, that the board was prepared to give to a good project to enable us to get some of those things going. I remember also, while at the board, I supported an organisation in those days called AJ6, the Association of Jewish Sixth
Forces. I was in AJ6.
Right. Well, AJ6 had a lot of difficulty getting, for example, you know, renting a space because it was a bunch of kids.
Right.
So I would bring the board in and go, well, we'll guarantee this and attend and make it all right. So I was given a lot of leeway. I was very lucky. I was given a lot of leeway by the board to pursue my own enthusiasms. So I was there, and then I became head at King David, Liverpool, and then became deputy director of the local education authority, Liverpool LEA, then headhunted back down to London for a thing called Jewish Continuity, which was the then chief rabbi, Lord Sachs's big initiative. And then went freelance and continued to do a whole range of different things, both inside and outside of the Jewish community. I must say that 3 years with Jewish Continuity was the only time in my life that I worked pretty well exclusively within the Jewish community. And I've always tried to have a foot on both sides of the chasm.
Why?
Because the world is both deep and wide. And I love the depth and intimacy of working in the Jewish world. And of course, the Jewish world is also very wide. I mean, it is a world, let's face it. But it has its own particular angle. And one of the exciting things about working outside of the Jewish community to go and do some educational advisory work in Southeast Asia or in Sub-Saharan Africa or Latin America or indeed Ormskirk is just to find the voice to talk to a different kind of world.
Do you find that the principles are similar or not?
In certain ways, many people cluster into communities and have that sense of relationship one with another, a certain intimacy.
But that seems to be your like community seems to be community education seems to be your bag, you know, in terms of Is that unfair?
No, I think that's probably right, although that's broadened into the generic business of kind of leadership and organisational management. So it's not because of that that I became chair of a hospital board, and it's not because of that that I was on the Metropolitan Police Authority. Those are other things. But they are a genuine interest in how communities care for themselves or how communities manage their delivery of their needs. Right. So I think it's become broader than that. And certainly, as far as education was concerned, from a very early stage, I was absolutely convinced that schools are really unhelpful. So while I was a head of a school, so I mean, I can't completely badmouth the institution, I'm deeply committed to the idea that education is what goes on, you know, when schools get out of the way most of the time. And
I'm a fellow ex-English teacher, so I get it.
Well, one of the things I loved about love about Limud is that it refuses to play the game of kind of hierarchy and experts and authorities and so on, and allows anybody who wants to teach something to anybody to do it, and trusts the student to make sense of the experience they're having. And I think an awful lot more of that.
That is such a diplomatic answer. Because, we're all, anyone who's been to Limud has sat in a session by someone who maybe is under research and is inexperienced. But then I suppose part of the Limud experience is allowing people to do that, right?
And to grow.
Yeah.
And they'll come back next year and they'll be a bit better, maybe. And certainly Limuds around the world have created a cadre of educators.
Can you, just for those who don't know what Limud is, can you just distill it in, I'll give you two sentences.
Okay. So Limud is an organisation, I suppose that's what one should say, is an organisation which creates events and opportunities in which the aspiration, the dream, the ideal is to bring the entire Jewish world into that place and allow people to learn whatever they like about Jewish things, Jewish stuff, without anybody telling them what they should learn or telling them what is more or less important or more or less pertinent. That's one sentence. And the second sentence,
a very long sentence.
Well, yes, I mean, I'm an English teacher after all. You know, I know about compound sentences. And the second sentence, I'm just going to quote the Limud strapline, the Limud mission, which is wherever you are on your Jewish journey, Limud undertakes to help you take one further step. So it's about you. It's not about we in Limud think this is what you need to learn or the ideal Jew should know this or any of those things. You ought to be moving. There's nothing duller and deader than a Jew who's smugly happy with what they know. So you ought to be trying, wanting. But what the next step is, who can possibly tell you? You need to, and you probably don't know yourself. So you come to something like Limud and you try some of this and you try some of that and you learn a bit of that and you listen to some of this. And over time, you begin to find your own direction or preference or growth area. And you might find many.
But it's interesting because that whole concept is to a certain degree opposite to what a lot of Rabbonim rabbis would say. Like there's some rabbis who are very much Limudniks and very much, you know, and I don't want to, but there's some who are like, you know, you need to be taught by experts.
Well, I think we've got to recognize something like, I mean, it's not just rabbis, it's professors as well. Such structures, such authority, such statuses are constructed on the authority that that individual has. The individual carries that status as a mark of their authority to say something decisive, definitive about whatever it is they're teaching, whether it's chemistry or Talmud. And therefore, they're going to be very uneasy about a bunch of people who turn up and go, well, let anybody do it. I don't know. I mean, lots of people. And of course, let's be honest, some people can deliver complete nonsense. They just don't know.
But I think the one thing I love about Limud is if you say anything that isn't 100% right, there will be someone who knows more than you who will be more than happy to correct you.
Well, of course, that's the beauty of adult learning. One of the realities of all other kinds of learning, whether it's kindergarten or university or whatever, is that there is a contract, which is the teacher knows more than the student, all right? It might just be a little bit more, but knows more than the student. And to some degree, also, they have a greater life experience, usually, than the student. So they can take the thing forward and they can draw themselves up to their full height and say to the student, you be quiet, I'm the person with authority here. In adult learning, you cannot do it. First of all, because frequently the people in the room have much more life experience than the teacher. They may well have much more wisdom. And of course, they may have more knowledge. Why does somebody come to my session on, I don't know, whatever it might be, Israel, let's say? Because they are very interested in Israel and they've made it their own life study. They'd like to know what I have to say about it. So there's lots of reasons for turning up. They might come because they've never heard of a session about Israel, or they might come because this is absolutely their favorite subject and therefore they know a lot more than I do. That's all part of the discursive dynamic of adult education, and it's a beautiful thing. I begin to believe that education ought to be X-rated and we shouldn't let children near it till they're about 18.
That's an interesting moral to take away, you know.
Well, it's where people learn, isn't it? It's when the learning goes on. We take children, I mean...
Right, because you're not learning, right? You're repeating.
Yeah. Well, you think about what we know. We know that little tiny toddlers, you know, up to about the age of five, just do not stop exploring, asking, they want to know everything, right? And then after that age has gone by, then we stick them in school, right? And slowly they become more and more bored with the world until by the time they're teenagers, they couldn't care less about anything. And they just roll their eyes and go, whatever. And they're not interested and they don't want to know anything. And then when they emerge from that teenagehood and they're slowly beginning to see the world is a place of interest and I need to get to grips with it and I want to understand what's happening and I need to be a player here, we chuck them out of school. So compulsory schooling spans the period of time when kids don't want to learn anything.
I was an inquisitive teenager, you know. I was an annoying, asking questions, trying to figure the world out. And I would wager that you were as well.
Yes, and this is the big mistake. We are people who were successful in the system. As you said yourself, you were a teacher, I was a teacher. We're the people who made it through. For teachers to judge the pertinence of the system by the people who succeed is to fail to notice the people for whom it says nothing, right? Schools, classrooms, curriculums, timetables, uniforms, all the trappings, discipline, for goodness sake, you know, we're not supposed to be police officers, we're supposed to be teachers. All of that business that goes on in British schools, and let's face it, the British have never liked children, so why would they want to do anything nice for them? All of that is not designed to deliver education. It's not designed to create learned, wise, autonomous individuals. It's designed to fit people into the system. It was more overt when you had grammar schools and secondary modern schools. We're going specifically, we have so many jobs in offices and so many jobs in factories, so that's what they better learn. But it's still pretty much there. We're not trying to create anybody, encourage anybody to think for themselves. That's the last thing we want to do.
So one, just to defend myself, I did write 9,000 words attacking Michael Gove's education policies of creating hegemonic structures. So I thought you'd like that.
Yeah, he hadn't been born by the time I was learning this stuff.
But no, I just think it's interesting then as to what we found frustrating in that process. Because I think what you've done a lot of incredible, successful things that have grown, you know. Limud, I don't think anyone could ever have expected it to be as big as it's now got. Or maybe you did. Maybe it was a massive. But, you know, like, you know, it's in how many countries, you know, like, you know.
It's about 40, 50 countries, about 95 different places around the world.
Right. So what were the, I'm always interested, what were the pressure points along the way?
Well, I said at the very first Limud, at which we had about 70 people back in 1980, I said, I see no reason why we shouldn't have 3,000 people here. So I don't know if that was just bravado or a genuine vision, but I do remember saying
it. Could have been both.
Right. but I do remember saying it. We haven't quite got there, but 2,500 is pretty close.
Why did you see a need for it in the first place?
Oh, because British jury was so dull and stupid. It was just boring. And we were going to spend the rest of our lives here. I mean, who could cope with that? It was a very ignorant community. And very smug and satisfied with its ignorance. It was a Philistine community, mostly. I mean, the Jew in the pew didn't have a clue. So this was about popularising the opportunity to learn. It was about giving people a chance to learn and think and do more and to broaden the sense of who had a right to Jewish stuff. That is, it shouldn't belong to some specialist or expert or nominated fellow with a qualification or something. So it was very much about democratizing Jewish learning, making it available to people, and democratizing the capacity to transmit what you knew to other people. So not saying, no, you're qualified, you're not qualified, you can speak, you can't speak. So that was there from the very beginning. I think we knew that there were a lot more interesting people in the community than any single individual would know. which, I mean, of course, one of the great fault lines of the community was between the Orthodox and the Progressive, say. So as a general rule, nobody in the Orthodox camp knew there was anybody interested in the Progressive camp, and vice versa. Nobody amongst the Progressives knew there was anybody interesting in the Orthodox. Stereotypes and stupidity about the other group. So, I mean, just simply to take that and give people an opportunity to find out there are interesting people there. But that's also true about, I don't know, Manchester to London or Scotland to England or young to old or any of those things, male to female, whatever. So just opening that whole thing up. Also, from the very beginning, it was important to us that there were people there from overseas because, again, Britain was and is becoming, again, pretty insular, inward-looking place.
Only 52% of the time.
Well, well, the vast majority of British Jews know nothing about Jews overseas and don't want to, really. You know, I mean, there are fascinating communities all around the world, and generally speaking. Yeah, I mean, if they go on holiday to some place, they might go and visit and come back and go, did you know, isn't it weird? But they're not really that interested. So we know a bit about American Jewry and are broadly contemptuous of it, and we know about a bit Israeli Jewry and don't know what it's all how it works. And that's about it. And otherwise, it's our own suburb, mostly.
Quick sidetrack on it, though. If there is anybody from any of those communities that wants to come on the Bagel podcast, I genuinely do want to hear from people that we don't hear from. Yeah, that's genuinely one of the reasons I started this is so that I would hear stories and hear about communities that no one hears about.
Right. Well, I mean, there are Turkish Jews here. There are Adeni Jews here. There are Indian Jews here. There are Jews from Romania. There are Jews from Italy. London, luckily, attracts people of all kinds. They're here. And you're right. It'd be lovely for people to hear of them and about them. And these communities are fascinating, and they throw a light on how one can live Jewishly, but not exactly as we do. You know, you've called this the Bagel podcast. I mean, half the Jews of the world wouldn't have a clue what that meant, right?
Right.
And just to know that, to broaden that sense. So we wanted at Limud as well that there should be overseas people because we wanted to produce a kind of paradoxical experience for people who came. On the one hand, we wanted them to go away saying, aren't we lucky to live in this place? Look at the resources we have. Well, I never knew what a rich, diverse, interesting crowd of people we had, that thing. But at the same time, we wanted them to go away going, my goodness, there's so much out there we didn't know about. I mean, how come Britain has never heard about this initiative, that idea, this development and so on? So we wanted people from overseas. It was nearly 20 years later that a chap called Andrew Gilbert, who was very significant in that sort of mid-stage of Limud's development, very, very significant in that, proposed that Limud could and should go to communities overseas. Now, it's not in the spirit of Limud to can try and sell itself or go and tell people what to do. But by that time, we had had people visiting from other countries, not only as presenters, but just simply because they liked it and wanted to come. And I was appointed very part-time first professional officer, executive director of Limud at that time. And so I made it my business, and not least prompted and nudged by Andrew, to approach these folk who are coming from other countries and saying, well, you know, why don't you create your own Limud? And started thinking about how to do it and advising them and training them and so on. So that's one of the reasons I got so involved in the business of training and developing these Limuds overseas. I probably worked with, I suppose, about three quarters of them over time, helping them grow their local teams and understand what makes Limud Limud and so on.
But I know that was an interesting point, but I know I've seen something over the past few years where it used to be that regional Limuds were about, so regional Limuds, daily Limuds that happen in other cities rather than the main 2,500, hopefully 3,000 conference festival. And it was that to find their own voice, whereas now there seems to be a bit of a branding unification that's going on, which is quite a different tact.
I'm not sure about that. I think that there's always been... what makes a Limud?
Learning.
Well, learning. There are, in fact, 10 values. Learning, obviously, is one of them. There are other things, respect and mutual responsibility and diversity, various things. Anybody who's attended Limud and thought about it a bit could probably dream up 6 or 8 of them straight away. Those values are what make a Limud a Limud. And if some group of people in Antarctica want to get together and do this thing, they will be told by Limud, well, what you need to do is you need to be sure that you follow through on these 10 values. And if you do that, You can call yourself a Limud, and we'd be very happy to have you come to join us at festival. We'll train your leaders and we'll send somebody out and work with you if you want. If you don't want, don't have to, but that's what it is. And that's part of joining the Limud family. There's no formal stipulation that says, and if you do that, don't you dare do anything other than use our logo or whatever it might be. But one of the reasons why people want to associate with Limud is because of its brand. It's now a worldwide famous thing. And to be able to say, you've heard of Limud, is now coming to your own doorstep, this global phenomenon, is a pretty fancy thing. So then, by all means, I mean, every Limud has its own logo. There are 95 logos. It's a beautiful thing to see. And they're all particular to that place in one way or another. But there is an international, global Limud logo, which we ask them to put on their material too. And it's to their benefit, because they can say we belong to this family. So that's what it is. And it's not a franchise in that sense, therefore. I mean, nobody's asked to sign a contract or pay a fee or anything like that. They're in a family.
And so how did that even develop? Like, it seems, because Limud now is rather sprawling, like in terms of the projects that Limud does. I mean, I'm a Limudnik, I would say, and I don't know 1% of what Limud does. Mm. So how is that even remotely manageable?
Well, it's one of those glorious little things, isn't it? I think it's there's a lot of trust involved. So you're not trying to control every feature of everything. You're trusting people because they've signed up to a similar shared culture and concept. It's a process of support. So if things are going well, you don't need to interfere with them. But if they're going badly or not as successfully as you'd like, because there's not a blame culture, because Limudniks want to support each other, then somebody will bring to Limud very quickly, this is not working, can you help us? Rather than, oh dear, we better hide it under the carpet, otherwise we'll be penalized or judged to have failed or whatever it might be. So I think that there's a very comfortable, fluent conversation amongst the various leaders around the world.
Do you think you have to be a certain type of person to have those leadership roles, to actually have the confidence to stand up and go, that's not working so well, or that's okay? Do you think that there might be a danger that there's some people who are chased away?
Well, there may be an illusion that there's some kind of ideal person or something, but that's a bit the same as somebody saying certain kinds of people can be parents and certain kinds of people can't. And that may actually be true, but the kinds are not along the categories that you and I might try to define. Clearly, some people become parents and afterwards you look at them and go, this person is no good at this. This is a catastrophe. You might be able to train them a bit. You might be able to help them a bit, but no doubt there are some people who are simply incapable of doing it. But generally speaking, you would say, well, anybody can have a go at this, and most people have enough sense to make it work well enough. And if you give them support, even better. And I think that's about leadership, really. This idea somehow that there's a special caste of people who are brilliant at leading and everybody else is rubbish. I mean, I think it's kind of important to remember, you know, that our key Jewish leader was Moses. And although he got a 40-year apprenticeship in Egypt, in the Egyptian court, so he learned to be haughty and imperious and directing and willful, he then needed to spend another 40 years being a Midianite shepherd in order to learn to become humble and obscure and less confident in himself. And it was only when he was about 80 that he became a Jew and learned that everybody complains. So I think, you know, Moses is quite an interesting model because he wasn't a kind of show-offy, listen to me, everybody, I'm the guy. I mean, you know, he even wasn't confident that he could talk to the people at all.
Well, he couldn't, right?
Well, we don't know as much. That's Midrash for you. But, you know, I think that's quite inspiring for us. And I know certainly when I do leadership training around the world in various different contexts, you work with the people that you're presented with. And there are a variety of ways of being a leader and skills of being a leader. You know, if you look back through British history and look at the various people who were prime ministers, you can't suggest they were all the same or all had the same qualities. All brought different things to that. And the lucky person is the one who knows how to capitalize on what they have. It's a lovely model, too, that Moshe says he can't do it. And he's given Aaron and Miriam turns up, too. And they make a kind of triumvirate. Because any decent leader is smart enough to know there's some things I can't do. And I'd do very well to have a trustworthy
partner. Sounds a bit like Harry Potter, right?
Well, it is in many. Look, there was nothing original in Harry Potter. Let's just remember that. But exactly that, and I think Lilymut, for example, one of Lilymut's tendencies is to prefer co-chairs of things and teams of people. The star leader is not what it's all about. It's the team that's the thing, and it's always lovely, isn't it, at the end of the festival where they have the gala and they bring up the team, and there you're presented with 25 people. Of every stripe. I mean, if you know those people personally, you'll know some of them are shy, retiring characters, and some of them just can't tear themselves away from a spreadsheet, and other people just have to be out there on a platform making speeches. And there's all kinds there. And then behind that 20, 25 people, there's another 100 people who are working within those sub-teams. And those people are slowly coming forward and going, wait a minute, you know, if he can do it, well, I could do that. You know, she had that job. That's like me. Well, I could do that differently or better or something. And so people keep coming forward. There's an endless conveyor belt of people coming forward. And Limud's instinct, which is to permit and encourage. Yeah, why not? Let's give it a go. See how they go. Well, why don't you step up to that? Rather than, oh, I don't know if you're up to it. You haven't done level 3 training before you. You know, means to say that people blossom because no human being uses their full potential. We are all of us dreadful at that. And therefore, if any organization or setting says, come here and do something with it, then people invariably impress. And that's one of the things wrong with schools. Again, we are constantly trying to decide how they've failed, how they're not good enough, how they haven't quite made the grade. Instead of giving people their heads and trusting them, you can get a bunch of adolescents in a school and you trust them. The sky's the limit. Right? Nobody's more creative, dynamic, enthusiastic, determined than adolescents when they're not being told what to do. And what do schools do? They screw them down and tell them to wear stupid ties and stuff like that, as if that's going to make them grow.
Have you seen the research, the fascinating research that says that one of the reasons why the UK produces a disproportionate number of creatives, so famous, you know, artists, musicians, whatever, is because of that authoritarian school system, which matches with living in a free society. So it means that kids can push against it. So they've got something to push against. Whereas in environments where everyone's all hippy-dippy and a bit like, you go and do whatever you want, they don't end up doing very much creative activity because they're given so much freedom they don't know what to do with it.
Well, that would work, perhaps, if the people who were the creatives were the people who largely succeeded through the system. But 9 times out of 10, they're dropouts, or they will tell you how the system never did them any good, or how they couldn't wait to get out, or whatever it may be. The entrepreneurial instinct is not mostly nurtured by schools. Now, I have to say, of course, there are certain schools which are shining exceptions to this, all up and down the country of every sort. And I think, generally speaking, Jewish schools, because of the idiosyncrasy of Jews, Jews are very committed to the individualism. I've got my rights, my opinion matters, and all of that. Means to say that schools are really, although they try desperately hard to pretend they're Eton, right, they couldn't whip people into shape at all, luckily. So the kids come out gloriously independent and individual, however hard the school tried to bang them into school uniform and so on. So that instinct of Jews to be entirely unorganizable is our saving grace, and it's one of the things that makes, I think, Jews frequently rise to the top in all kinds of structures. But no, I don't think it's our regimented structure that makes us infinitely more exciting and creative. It's an interesting thing, certainly in the 60s and 70s, that the people who went to art school who came out and did this stuff. It's not the people who got lots of A-levels and went to university and went to the public schools and so forth. Of course.
Although now it is, right? So
I was going to say what the public schools have done is they've got ahead of the game. Again, frequently they get ahead of the game, and they now know that cultivating people's individuality and their artistic skills and so forth, much more important than just trying to get them to jump through a bunch of hoops. Ultimately, if you've been to Eton, having 24 GCSE grade A stars is not what's going to make you prime minister. It's about your capacity to debate.
Or getting PPE from Oxford.
Yeah, well, but that's right. But you know how to do that. And they teach you the self-confidence to walk in and shake hands and sell yourself. Mm. And it's that, again, that Jews are good at, because Jews have that, you know, wonderfully disproportionate self-confidence. And so to that extent, that's, there's a remarkable virtue and privilege that Jews have.
So Yeah, it's interesting about the confidence thing, though. Is it? Do you think Jews do have that confidence, or do you think the Jews that everyone's heard of and seen have that confidence, which are two very different things?
Yeah, I think Jews are lippy, as a general rule. They talk more, they argue more. I think this is something to do with the Jewish tradition of argument and debate and questioning. I mean, you know, at Seder, the four questions, the little kids got to ask some questions, and this bizarre British line, you know, children should be seen and not heard. I mean, it's an impossible concept in a Jewish world. And then everybody goes, oh, shush, shush, little Chaim is going to say something. And, you know, 25 adults around the table have to shut up while he whitters on about some nonsense. And, you know, they all go, oh, he's so clever, he's all right, you know. So everybody thinks that every child is amazing, and that's wonderful. And I think that generally speaking, there is that tremendous enthusiasm and commitment. By the way, I think Bar Mitzvah is a remarkable element in that process. And when I was head at King David in Liverpool, half of our children were not Jews, and the other half were, obviously, and a significant proportion of my staff were not Jews. But they told me that even if they didn't know which weekend a boy was Bar Mitzvah, they could tell on Monday. He walked a little taller. Something had happened over that weekend where that boy did cross a line. Now, you and I may not observe that because we're so preoccupied with how many Parker pens he's got and the stupid, you know, sculpted and chopped liver and whatever. And we know all the excesses and stupidities of it. But something goes on inside that boy at that moment, at age 13, that makes him think, I should take myself seriously. Now, it might wear off after a few months or something, but it's happened to him and it is in there. I think that's highly significant, and it's marvellous to see it happening now for girls as well. Of course, girls go through a different thing, which is menstruation. So whether or not they had had that ceremony, they also go through a moment where they suddenly, consciously or unconsciously, stand a bit taller and go, oh, blimey, I've become an adult. I'm now childbearing. Potentially. I mean, unimaginable, isn't it, for us as men to know what that's about. But I think that's remarkable. And I think despite what we say about the traditions of, you know, men and women, women don't get a go and stuff, generally speaking in the Jewish world, women, I think, have been pretty assertive and participatory and listened to.
I still think in terms of leadership roles, it's only recently, right, where I think women have started to get those seniors.
Well, to take leadership roles in mixed environments, so yes, to become president of the board of deputies or whatever, yes. But what did women do then instead? They set up equally potent female organisations because they couldn't break in. So they set up something like WEETZO. I mean, nobody took no notice of WEETZO. It wasn't a nothing organisation. The League of Jewish Women. I mean, these were significant bodies that still are. Yeah. Make a big impact on the community and make demands of the community. You can't ignore them. You can't pretend they're not there.
You can't ignore WEETZO.
Well, that's right. Exactly. And it was go-getting. It was creative. It was dynamic. It was assertive. It was all of those things, and gave lots of women again the opportunity to train and participate. And when you compare that with its sister organisations like, the Towns Women's Guild or those kinds of things, it is astonishing the level of assertiveness, creativity, determination. And think of the 35s in the Soviet Jewry movement, bunch of women who came together and said, we are going to deal with this. There's no sign then that somehow women were told to wait while the men got their act together or something. The women just went and did it. And people like Nathan Sharansky are perfectly clear that the 35s were hugely significant in the Soviet Jewry campaign.
I need to tell my quick Limud Nathan Sharansky story.
Right.
So this was whenever he, I don't know when it was, was it maybe 5 years ago we came to Limud, something like that. And I was doing tech, I was probably doing some video or audio stuff. And I was at the back of RAM 1, the lecture room RAM 1, where they had their own tech booth. And I was just in there, fiddling with it. And then before I know it, door flies open. Nathan Sharansky comes in, storms in, closes the door because he wanted to get away from all the people, and just starts like staring at me, pacing, going, I need to get away from these people. I need to get... And he just starts like pacing. And I'm like, I'm not going to start fanboying on Nathan Sharansky when he's in that movie. And I just got away from him. And it was such a wonderful experience. It would only ever happen at Limud.
Well, it's a wonderful thought, isn't it, that a man who was subjected to solitary confinement and prison finds too many people unacceptable and wants to get himself into a little cell and pace up and down in order to be happy. Goes to show nobody's quite happy with whatever situation they're in.
Right. I feel like we could go on for quite a while, I think I'd probably like to get you back at some point in the future to maybe do a part two. But for the moment, Clive Lawton, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that. And if you want to hear more round the year from Clive, he does a lot of Jewish teaching at JW3 in London and at Limwood events across the known universe. The main second episode is coming in the next, I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks or something. It depends how busy life gets. I want to try and have a schedule, but, you know, life's hard and gets in the way of podcasting. Grrr. Until next time, share and share alike. BagelPodcast.com. I'm on Facebook, it's on Twitter, it's everywhere you'd expect to be, really. Until then, Shalom Aleichem.